friends and enemies, welcome to another episode of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast, the Wednesday interview rip today. Here as always, my co-host Len, and we are brought to you as always by ShakePay, the mighty ShakePay, best place to buy and sell, though you should never sell Bitcoin in Canada.
You said a Wednesday rip. It's Tuesday.
Oh yeah, it's Tuesday. Jeez, I forgot the day. We usually do these on Wednesdays. I guess our schedule is all over the place now, thanks to my injury rehab. So anyway, that ShakePay has great spreads, great mobile app, and if you use our promo code SIGNUPCBP, you can receive $30 on your first $100 buy, which is pretty good, I think. That's not a bad way to make 30 bucks. If you use a promo code to sign up, you can shake your phone every day for free Satoshis. They just funnel them to your wallet. It's a piece of cake, no problem at all. And of course, the Sats Bag Visa card, which is pretty dope. Although I personally can't use it because I'm, you know, immobile right now, but it seems like soon, as I was saying to Len, I'll be walking, meandering around the city as I was before, getting up to no good and stirring up trouble. Did I miss anything there, Len?
No, you got it all. It's especially the stirring up trouble part, Joey. You know, and it's good that you're getting healthy, you're starting to walk around, because we're going to have some tours coming up in a not too distant future, from what I understand. We're going to be reaching out to some of the people that are setting up shop in Ontario, and we're going to go for a drive, Joey. We will go for a drive and start checking out these Bitcoin mining operations.
We very likely won't be going for a drive to the mining operation run by our guest today. He's in the green room. His name is Daniel Roberts. He's the CEO, co-CEO of Iris Energy. We're going to bring him in. Daniel, it's great to see you. Thanks for coming on. I know it's the crack of dawn over there on the other side of the world, so I appreciate that. You know, Len and I oftentimes ask our guests the same questions about what got them started in Bitcoin, what got them started with mining, and you're not going to be any different. You have a sort of unique story. A little bit of a background on yourself would be nice here for the listeners. Tell us where Iris started, and how did you get into Big Orange? This is really the thing that everyone is asking, especially as the price is pumping. When did you get in? How did you get in? We need to know more.
Yeah, for sure. And first of all, thanks for having me, guys. Absolute pleasure to be here. So the orange coin. So I think it was probably around 2013. First got involved, bought on the run up to about $1,000 at that time. Bought a few, and then it crashed back down to 500. And I thought, this is nonsense, and sold it all. So that was the beginning. It wasn't the greatest start. And then I don't know. I don't think it's that uncommon over time. It's like, hang on, this Bitcoin thing. It's kind of, it doesn't die. Like, everyone keeps saying it's dying, but it's like it keeps coming back. And went into the Ethereum pre-sale in 2014, did well out of that, played around in the ICO boom in 2016, 2017. And then it was probably the back half of 2017 that Will, my brother and co-founder of Iris, and I kind of did the deep dive on Bitcoin and said, hang on, like, this thing's pretty incredible. The game theoretical aspects of it, the self-reinforcing, it's like people talk about blockchain, but as much as anything, it's kind of this intersection of game theory, incentive structures, etc., that all comes together in a seemingly almost perfect way. And you say, well, if there's only going to be 21 million of them and this thing's here to stay as we enter this digital exponential age, how does this not create this positive flywheel of self-validation and the store of value monetary asset, where the longer it survives, the lower the perceived risk, the marginal buyer comes in, supply goes lower, price goes up, that then attracts more entrants, the higher price then underpins the value as a store of value and attracts more entrants. And you go, gee, you play this out, it's a really interesting dynamic. And I think sitting here today, and looking at, you know, events unfolding around the world, both live time and over the last 12 months, it's Bitcoin's value proposition has, I'm not sure it's ever looked clearer.
It's number go up technology. It's definitely, it's built in it. And you've been in it for a little while, so good for you. Joey and I, we've only been in it since 2017. So you could school us, I guess, in the earlier days of what it was like to be in Bitcoin. But in terms of your company, Iris Energy, tell us a little bit about the process to get to becoming publicly traded when you IPO'd sometime mid to late last year. I'm curious to know, what was the process? What's the fanfare? And, you know, I'm curious to know a little bit more about that.
Yeah, paying a lot of bankers and advisors was part of it. But no, look, we were We were the first and only, I think, so far, bulge bracket bank-led IPO in the mining sector to date. Obviously, a huge endorsement of the platform that we're building, the focus on institutional-grade infrastructure and the sustainability aspects of that. So very pleased and, you know, very strong relationships with those people that helped us through that process today. But the lead up to it, we explored everything. You know, Australian Stock Exchange listing, TSX, SPACs, direct listings, and ended up settling on the IPO. So we certainly learned a lot in the process, but doing a regular IPO, doing it properly, was where we landed. Good experience, got it away last November. And haven't looked back in terms of the underlying business.
Okay, Dan, I have to ask, okay? On this show, we often speak ill of the ESG crowd. Now, I'm not going to do that to you because you seem like a nice guy and I like the stuff Iris is doing. But all that to say, I still have to ask, okay? For someone like me who, you know, as a retail investor, I don't often think about the ESG angle when I'm picking the companies to invest in. I think about the bottom line angle and no other angle on top of that. So why should... First of all, tell me a little bit about what Iris is doing with ESG, because I think it's unique compared to some of your counterparts. And tell me why, as a retail investor, I should care. And if you can, I'm not sure if this is, you know, I don't know if this is like Robert's Rules of Orders violation or something like that. But is there something you can tell me about the capital, the process for, where you guys were raising money and are continuing to sort of garner interest that's really helped along by the ESG work that you're doing at Iris?
Yeah, I mean, and I think to set the scene, ESG, it's almost one of those buzzwords, right? Like blockchain or AI, just whack it on a business and hopefully raise money. So I think what you actually said around bottom line is kind of like, it all kind of comes back to that ultimately, and getting that social license to operate. If you don't tick the ESG box for institutions, you simply are removing a huge source of capital from the market. Like, that is the reality of the world today. And we're seeing in fossil fuels, et cetera. Whether you like it or not, if you want to grow a business, like, you need to do that. But for us, that's almost the easy aspect, because our philosophy since day one has been not only target renewables, but also only enter markets where we're actually solving a problem, delivering positive externalities. Like, never be accused of, you know, taking power away from mums and dads and pushing up power prices. Like, fundamentally focus on solving the problems in these energy markets that have popped up over the last 10 years. And we can delve into what those energy market problems are, but it's around the demand response, supporting renewables, the intermittency and all those grid issues that we've seen. It's a slightly different problem in British Columbia, but there's also a general philosophy that Will and I had, which was, we're going into jurisdictions, we own all the land, but we're using other people's land, other people's infrastructure, working with local communities. Like, we're monetizing, you know, this enormous digital innovation, we're making good money. Like, give back. Like, don't be overly greedy. Integrate into these energy markets, into the communities, educate them on Bitcoin, educate them what we're doing. Don't be seen as the bad guys, like, be seen as the good guys. See, how do you give back? So integrating the energy markets is one way. We've got, you know, $500,000 a year program with the local First Nations communities at our first site in Canal Flats. We sponsor the hockey clubs, the fires, like the fireys. Like, we do as much as we think is possible to really get that social license to operate and, you know, win the hearts and minds of the people that we're working alongside.
I like this idea. I've heard you say this a few times, and I've heard other interviews where you say it as well. And to your credit, Dan, I've never heard another miner, executive, mining officer, it doesn't matter, use this phrase, social license to operate. Where did you come up with this? Is this something you guys thought up at Iris, or did you get this from somewhere? Because I have to say, I really like that term. I think that's a really good term to keep in your pocket when you're rolling out something that sometimes there are, you know, headwinds that make it difficult, like Bitcoin mining at the moment. Where did that come from?
I think it might be from the infrastructure fund manager that our president, Lindsay Ward, and I built over the last decade, or up until 4 years ago when I stepped back from my executive role there. That's an infrastructure funds management business. We grew to around $6 billion of assets. So ports, airports, wind farms, solar farms, gas pipelines, basically deploying long duration pension fund and insurance company money into unlisted infrastructure assets. And the majority of those assets were regional assets where we were owning key pieces of infrastructure in these regional communities. And I think that's probably a similar thread where you wanted to be seen as the good guys. Like, you're not in there to always be maximizing your bottom line for these pension funds and insurance companies. Like, you're there to integrate into the communities. You're providing these valuable services that are integral to the operation of those local economies, communities, employment, etc. Never take that for granted.
What made you settle on putting or setting up shop in BC? I believe it's Mackenzie and Prince George. And that's quite a ways away from your home office in Sydney. So I'm curious, what was the decision making for you to set up shop in that neck of the woods versus anywhere else? I'm just curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, a lot of trips and backpack hostels in the early days, and particularly my brother Will spent a lot of time covering the world. And I think the filter we applied was our skill set is raising, deploying, managing institutional capital. What's the right type of market? So we've kind of focused on Western bankable jurisdictions. And early on, we copped it, right? Oh, you can't compete in this sector. You've got to be getting 2 cents in China or 3 cents in Iran or Venezuela. And it's like, yeah, okay, just wait. Like, it's not how the world works. In fact, at risk of digressing slightly, there's a really good chart or graphic that shows the top five gold producers by cost per gold mined. And you get all sorts of different countries in there. And then you go to top five gold producing nations by volume, USA, Canada, Australia, like all the bank, like capital flows to where the risk profile. So that's a slight digression, but we thought, you know, North America, Australia, Western economies. And then thought, well, where is there a high penetration of renewables? And where is there a problem that we can solve? And we actually stumbled across two gentlemen, both called Brian Fair, Brian Fry, both Canadians, BC. Brian Fair, Canadian industrialist, built a $1 billion family construction business, actually got the Order of British Columbia several years ago for his work in regional communities. He and Brian Fry, who co-founded a company called Rackforce in the early 2000s, which grew to be one of Canada's largest cloud computing data center platforms, before he sold out about 6 years ago to TerraGo. Those two Bryans had created a site in Canal Flats, built a couple of early prototype data centers. We teamed up with them, ended up integrating and buying them out, integrating them into our business. And that gave us kind of the platform from which we've launched into BC and beyond since then. And the opportunity in British Columbia is a huge oversupply of hydro.
Yes.
Now, the issue with an oversupply of hydro in a regulated market is the way the power market works is someone needs to pay for all the infrastructure and the capital that's been deployed. And if you don't have enough users, then the residual users have to pay more for their power because the utility is allowed to earn their regulated return on the CapEx. And what you've seen is the closure of the pulp and paper industry in BC over the last decade. And you've got this dynamic where you've got new supply coming online. So Site C in the north of the province, more hydro, but demand's fallen off a cliff because of this large scale manufacturing and industry leaving. So this gap needs to be filled. So we're going into places like Mackenzie, Prince George, Canal Flats, and often locating near to where pulp and paper mills have closed down, not only using that surplus hydro and giving BC Hydro a revenue line that they don't need to go and then find from other users of power, but also leveraging a lot of the sunk capex in these electricity markets, like the transmission line capacity, substations on some occasions, etc., and locating back into the towns that have been decimated by the closure of this industry. Yeah, we don't employ as many people as a pulp mill, but we are employing tens of people. We are bringing local economic activity back to those regions. And the project in Mackenzie, we actually teamed up with the local council. We bought the land from them, piece of prime real estate. They've helped us with all the development planning, BC Hydro discussions to date. And it's a very good relationship. And again, I think that's just symptomatic and illustrative of the partnership and community approach that we try to take as much as we can to these projects.
Dan, what would you say if I told you that some miners, to your point about bankability in a region, some miners view this as sort of a chicken and egg problem, where bankability will come if they set up shop in a region like LATAM, for example, first, and, you know, bring that bankability through capital deployment and, you know, like you mentioned, educating the local population on these types of things, working with government, working with, you know, regional groups. Is that something you guys have considered? And if you have or haven't, I guess, what would it take for you to consider that as an option?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, bankability is not a term that we get to decide. And it's not a term other Bitcoin miners get to decide. It's dictated by institutional capital, right? They decide based on the risk profile of a jurisdiction. Like at a personal level, I think it's fantastic because you're decentralizing hash power in the network. You're adding strength and robustness to the security of the network. I think it's absolutely sensational. But equally, I know where our strengths are, where our focus is, and where we can build a good business. And we've got a specific strategy. And the best thing about capital markets and for people today is there's 15, 20 different other miners, and investors have got the choice. Like, you get to place your bets, you get to back different strategies, different approaches. And I just think that's wonderful. I'm not going to rule out going into Latin America over time or doing anything. I'll never rule anything out. But today, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit in these Western jurisdictions, and we've got an enormous growth prospect.
One of the strategies you have going forward, from what I read, is you're planning to get to 22 exahash per second in 2023, which is a humongous number. So I give you guys kudos to get there. What is some of the challenges to achieve this humongous hash rate? Is it the getting the funding and to deploy the capital? And also, what's the best way to achieve getting the funding to fund this type of project? Is it through dilution of the company? Is it borrowing against equipment or selling the Bitcoin? Like, what is the best way to achieve?
Never sell. We never sell on this program, Dan. Careful with this answer.
If you just to address that point, if we monetize one Bitcoin today, we can either hold that on balance sheet or buy some more miners and be generating a new Bitcoin every 7 months on the current difficulty level. So. Mm-hmm. No one should ever accuse us of not being bullish Bitcoin. We're literally compounding and doubling down on our Bitcoin exposure. So be very careful. The 22 exahash. So maybe just setting a bit of context, like, we've been very deliberate since day one not to publish forecasts or aspirations or make silly statements that you don't follow through with, right? Like, that's not, crypto's got a bit of a name for it. Self, right? Like, everyone sells, everyone's got a narrative. Like, we only talk about what we're actually doing. So what we are doing is we are actively constructing 765 megawatts of power and data center infrastructure. That is what we are doing. That has the potential to house 22 exahash of computers. We have not said that we'll definitely go to 22. We've just said that's the facts. What we have secured is 15 exahash of computers. Again, fact, binding contracts, price caps, $40 a terahash, current markets, you know, far higher than that. Great deal in hindsight. That's what we're doing. That's what we're delivering on. In terms of the funding, I'll pause there for comment, and then I'll move on to funding.
No, I have nothing to say. I mean, it's an incredible number to get to 15. That's a humongous number. So kudos to you for achieving that or trying to achieve that.
No, appreciate that. So 10 of that will be online early 23, so early Q1, and then the balance is being delivered over the next 6 months after that. In terms of funding, this is where it's starting to get really interesting in the sector. We've raised about $500 million to date, about 90% of that equity, small amount of hardware finance. I think the capital market options are expanding live time. So we saw Bitfarms 2 days ago announce a hardware financing deal. I think the metrics were around $50 a terahash. We only paid $40 a terahash. You extrapolate that against 15 exahash, you're talking a potentially very large source of capital. That's the first point. You've then got the opportunity to look at things like LCs and creative structures for building out substations, which is a reasonable CapEx item. You've then got traditional financiers who are more comfortable with data center land type exposures, so the non-computers, which is great. If you've got a very good source of capital for computers, then it's the residual CapEx that you're then looking to finance. Then, particularly being a listed company, all of a sudden you're opening up capital markets like Term Loan B facilities, baby bonds, maybe convertibles over time. But for us in an industry where you're spitting out all this cash flow every day, and it's very easy to validate, it's very easy to see, the opportunity to leverage that cash flow into non-dilutive financing is something that we're very excited about over time.
Dan, one of the things that, you know, I remember from 2017, you would know more about this than me, of course, but I'd like to hear you to talk about it a little bit. You know, when 2017 sort of came and went, that ICO boom, I think, took with it on the bust side of that cycle a lot of the interest from financiers. And one thing that I've been curious about in this sort of last, let's say, 5 months-ish, I guess since November, the November high, we went down about 50% or maybe a little more even. What have you seen from the financing side? Has it been lockstep with the price, or is it much different than it was in you know, previous downturns, where there is still this interest, still capital available, still money available to you guys and other companies, you know, like you, even though the price is low? And are you having to have conversations with financiers about this is what the asset is, this is why the downturn is not that important, et cetera, et cetera? Because it seems to me when I step back and look at the traditional investing space, a lot of people who I think should understand Bitcoin just want to dunk on it when it's down instead of talking about how to invest in it. What are you seeing on your end?
It's a really good question. And so this whole institutional narrative, like on one hand, I'm going to say it's so overdone, but on the other, I'm thinking to do a backflip and say it's so underdone. And to unpack that, like, you look at everything over the last 12 to 18 months. Oh, the institutions are coming. Institutions are accumulating Bitcoin. It's like, all right, let's slap ourselves on the back and like pretend that it's happening. I don't think it's really happening to the point people would love to feel that it is. You know, someone reports that Morgan Stanley's bought, you know, Bitcoin. It's probably like retail people, and Morgan Stanley's the custodian, or you know, a BlackRock or a Fidelity is now on the share register of, you know, Bitcoin related companies. Like, guys, it's a passive ETF. They're literally forced to buy it because it's part of an index. So, like, I know that's not what people want to hear, but like, we've got to be a bit realistic. So on that hand, I say, come on, it's been overdone, and it has been. But the flip side is, like, there is a wave of interest underlying. Like, institutions are slow, they're careful, they don't want to, like, capital preservation and getting it wrong, they do not want to get it wrong. So they are patient, and they are working throughout the cycle. Even before Bitcoin ticked up in the last couple of days, like, no one says, oh, what if Bitcoin doesn't hang around? Like, the prospect of Bitcoin going to zero is non-existent over the last 12, 18 months. I don't remember the last meeting where someone said, oh, what's the value proposition for Bitcoin? It seems to be a complete given in every meeting. And it's all about now starting to understand, well, what are the specific risks to Bitcoin mining as an industry? How do I look at the risk return through an institutional lens? And how does someone like Iris manage that risk return paradigm versus other players in the space? Because this is me paraphrasing, I want to get in, but I also don't want to stuff it up because I'm a fiduciary and I'm deploying lots of capital. So I'm super encouraged, but like, we've just got to be patient.
For the profits that you're going to be earning, like, what are some of the biggest challenges keeping the profit margin so high, or even high enough that it's going to appease your investors? Is it something like some of the challenges, like more companies adding hash rate to the network, or is it something like the halving, which we know that's going to be coming up, and you could basically predict when it's going to be coming up and how it's going to drop your profit margin? So which of the two is really the bigger of the two challenges for you earning a profit? Is it a combination of the two, or one of the two is more a bigger concern for you?
So Bitcoin mining economics, let's try and set a framework for looking at this. And I'll express it in power market terms. So if you pay 2 to 4 cents for your power, let's just park that for a second. what you're basically doing is monetizing every kilowatt hour in the current market around 25 cents a kilowatt hour. So there's your kind of 90% profit margins. Now, that 25 cents is far more important than whether you pay 2 or 2.5 cents, right? Like that's dictating the lion's share of your profitability. What is the risk to that 25 cents a kilowatt hour? That is dictated by two things. One is what's the price of Bitcoin? Two, how many Bitcoin are you getting? How many Bitcoin you are getting is dictated by how many available Bitcoin there are every 10 minutes through block subsidy and transaction fees, and what your share is of that. Mm-hmm. So what your share of the global hash rate is, basically, if you've got 1% of the global network in computing power, you get 1% of those coins every 10 minutes. Like you've just got to accept that as fact. Yes, it's random. Yes, there's probability. Yes, there's luck. But all those mining pools out there take on that risk on your behalf. So every day we get paid a fixed amount of Bitcoin directly corresponding to the amount of computing power we've sent to the network. We did take risk early on and it was up and down and the whole luck and probability. But today, constant stream, predictable. Now, they're the main drivers. So you play with that. So Bitcoin, you know, has an 80% drawdown, that's going to hurt. Bitcoin goes up 5x, that's going to help. If the hash rate doubles or triples, that's going to hurt. If the hash rate halves, that's going to help. So that's kind of the way to think about it. But what if we step back and look at the whole macro case for mining and why we went into it is we've hit this inflection point over the last kind of 18 to 24 months. And there's two key drivers. One is the technology advantage is disappearing slash has disappeared. And in that, I'm referring to, if you go back to CPUs, GPUs, ASICs, for years, the manufacturers of the ASICs held the competitive advantage because they would mine on their own balance sheet using the latest technology. 6 months later, send the old stuff to general public, rinse and repeat. So as the average punter, you couldn't compete, right? They were always front running you on the tech. Like, good on them. But what you could see was the technology curve was plateauing. Very quickly, these manufacturers were innovating and approaching the curve of traditional computing. Now, fast forward to today. They've caught traditional computing. They're now competing with the likes of Google and Amazon to get access to 7 5-nanometer wafers from TSMC and Samsung. Yes, there's pricing power and a scarcity attribute, et cetera, but in a world where fundamentally everyone has access to the same efficiency hardware, the whole battleground shifted towards the energy and infrastructure and organizations that can build out large-scale platforms and access institutional capital. So changing competitive advantage. And those chips, because they're becoming more commoditized, are lasting a lot longer. Mm-hmm. So this old narrative of, oh, Bitcoin mining machines only last 2 years, it's just false. Like we've said to people, it's not the way it works. Yes, if you put them in shipping containers or old abandoned warehouses, let them overheat, get dusty, humid, yeah, sure, they'll last 2 years. Like, well done. But commercially, even the S9s that were released almost 6 years ago, they're still monetizing power at like 8-9 cents a kilowatt hour. Yeah. Like these things and the stuff we're buying more than 3 times more efficient. So they could conceivably last a very long time, which is why we're building out proper institutional grade infrastructure, et cetera. Now, coming back to the macro, when Bitcoin was small, it was easy when Bitcoin ran 5, 10X for the real world to build out more mining capacity, bring online more supply, thereby diluting everyone's return and share of the Bitcoin to normalize returns. So when it was say 50 megawatts, price runs 5, 10X, the world can find 300, 400, 500 megawatts, plug in the computers, and after a while, the hash rate catches up to the price. But we were sitting here 18, 24 months ago with the Bitcoin price at 8 to 10 grand with 8 gigawatts, give or take, of power securing this network. Bitcoin runs 5X, fundamentally different paradigm we've now entered. To try and normalize those returns, to try and bring online enough mining supply, you now need like 25 to 30 gigawatts of power. The entire global data center industry is like 23. Like you need $70 billion of capital. And yes, institutional money's here, it's coming, like all that stuff. Like the listed markets raised, what, 4 or 5 in the last 12, 18 months? And then finally, even if you get the power, you get the capital, you're still waiting like 4, 5, 6 years of these scarce semiconductors out of Asia in the middle when people can't build cars. So like all these lowest common, and if you can't get any of those pieces, you're not bringing online more mining supply. You're not getting a piece of that digital exponential pie. And if we play this out even further, I think we can sit here and say like Bitcoin's not a 40, 50 grand asset, right? Fast forward, it either has to continue this kind of exponential adoption and growth, or it kind of tails off into insignificant, loses the network effect, and we're kind of back at scratch. So if you're right, this wedge is only getting bigger and greater, and this dislocation between your digital exponential revenue line and the ability to bring online more real-world capacity to monetize it is going to get wider and wider. So if you can bring online that real-world capacity, you're sitting on this enormous optionality and exposure to this digital exponential asset class.
What an answer, eh?
That's rolling downhill, Len. We got him.
Yeah, you got me started.
That's what we like to see. Okay, so Dan, talk to me about the sort of dynamic between halvings. I guess let me frame it this way. In 2016, okay, during the halving in that epoch, you know, when the price halves, a lot of miners have to go offline because they can't be profitable, like you mentioned, at the diluted reward, right? 2020, you know, I don't know if that would have been the first halving where a lot of miners didn't go offline, but because it was just after COVID, the price was on a steep drop because of that, you know, initial market shock. I think a lot of miners went offline at that time too. But then this next halving, nobody's going offline, right? Everyone is going to do whatever they got to do with the low interest rates, easy money. They're going to do whatever they got to do to stay online. So what does this look like for a miner where, you know, you guys are so well positioned, for example, that in the past, this would have given you, let's say, a 4 month or 5 month stretch where you're dominating hash rate in a way that you weren't leading up to that halving. This next halving, I mean, I don't think it's going to be like that, but I'd like to hear your thoughts. What are your thoughts about what's going to happen to hash as that reward dilutes and it gets more and more difficult to make a profit? Because to your point, it seems to me like no one thinks this thing is going away anymore the same way they did in 2016 and maybe did in 2020, but because of, you know, other macro events, we're not sure. What do you think the next one's going to look like?
Yeah, and I think what you're saying is exactly consistent with the fact that you can't build enough hash rate to come online for the next halving. So everyone's making so much money, why are you going to switch off? And because of that, it's kind of right way risk. If everyone's making money so everyone can stay online, then by definition, we're making a lot of money and it's not a problem. But if the flip side plays out and people aren't making money, then all those high cost miners drop out of the cost curve. The network shrinks, our share of that pie goes up, we receive more Bitcoin and receive that kind of live downside protection to our cash flows, because notwithstanding the price of Bitcoin's gone down, we're mining more Bitcoin every 10 minutes to partially compensate for that. So I viewed it completely as right way risk. You know, I'd rather Bitcoin was higher. I'd rather mining profitability was higher. And by definition, I'd rather that the hash rate stays high because everyone's making money, including us.
In terms of equipment, are you tied to one particular manufacturer or are you just getting whatever it is you could get? Because you mentioned there's a chip shortage and there's a long lead time to buy equipment right now. So I know you're planning to expand your operations. So I'm wondering which manufacturers are you buying from? One particular one or is it whatever's available?
We've bought from many, you know, your MicroBTs, Canons, Bitmains, over time. We're manufacturer agnostic, we're independent, we'll continue to make the best decisions for the business. The reality is the majority of that 15 exahash that we've got currently secured is with Bitmain. We've got a good deal. They're efficient. Yeah, they're probably industry leading, I think, quite clearly these days. The S19 model, it's a throwback to the S9s. They're just built so well, so reliable, operating fantastically. It's really hard to go past at the current point in time. But that's not to say that we won't use others in the future, and we're active dialogues with all of them. We're monitoring Intel. I think we've got a meeting scheduled with Intel next week. Oh. We're talking with Canon, talking with MicroBT. Like, you just got to cover the market, right? And remain open-minded.
I'm curious about these Intel miners, Dan. And we talk about them on our show pretty often. And we were impressed this week with the jump between Gen 1 and Gen 2. And so I'd be curious. I mean, you can't really speak on it too much, I guess, since you haven't spoken to them just yet. But, you know, what are you hearing from your counterparts in the industry about these things? Is it a lot of optimism, or do you think that Bitmain, you know, can really put some more chips on the table and run these guys off the market as well?
Yeah, I haven't met them yet, so I can't add much more. But I think in terms of industry sentiment, there seems to be a little bit more positivity towards Intel versus Newminer. time will tell. Look, I'm not a chip guy. I'm not a technical guy. But what I have gathered over the last 4 or 5 years is it's pretty hard to build these things. I think GMO, the Japanese group, toasted $300 million trying to develop an ASIC back in 2017. Like, just had to write it off. Like, I think there's a lot more challenges than what you might think. I think it's good. Like, if Intel enters the market, they've got diversified supply chains, differentiated products. I think that's only a good thing for the network. But I think it's just wait and see, right? And you know, if they're good and they're proven, then we'd love to look at them.
Every time I talk to somebody from a Bitcoin mining company, I always have to ask this question about immersion cooling. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to be spared from this as well. Mm-hmm. Is this something that you're looking at for your particular rigs? I know in BC, the temperature over there is not too hot, so I'm not sure how well it would work in that environment. But still, it might allow you to overclock the equipment or maybe have them work at a much longer duration than originally manufactured, so the lifespan will be much longer. So what are your thoughts on immersion cooling? Is it something you're going to be doing for your business?
Yeah, certainly very open-minded, and conceptually, theoretically at least, it makes a lot of sense. I think the issue for us is risk profile and just stepping outside. Like, I personally know someone who did immersion cooling 4 months in, the capacitors swirled up and popped off the hashboards, mm-hmm. and they were ruined. And you go, like, do you really want to be taking that level of risk? And that's not to say that that's going to be the case everywhere, but like, it was one very well validated example. I thought, oh gee, got to be careful. We don't need to do immersion. Like, we've got a fantastic air cooled design. It's been operating up to 40 degrees Celsius temperatures. It's fine for Canada. It's fine for Texas. You know, with Texas, it's really important to distinguish between west and north into the panhandle and then down towards the southeast, because down towards Dallas and Houston, the humidity is too much. Like, the chips can't handle it, right? So you're kind of forced to do immersion. The air cooled just cooks the chips, whereas as long as the air is dry, then the air cooled can work into the more desert arid conditions. So today, like, again, it comes back to the approach we've taken to this business. Don't kick an own goal. The cash flows, the opportunity is just enormous. Don't enter into short-term hosting contracts where you're trusting other people with your computers, trusting them to get online, trusting them to give them back to you in 2 or 3 years in some sort of condition. Don't enter into short-term leases. Like, own and control everything. So we own the land, the infrastructure, the data centers, the substations, the computers. Just get these facilities online, get them humming, and the rest takes care of itself. So we are pretty conservative when it comes to that type of stuff.
Dan, let's talk a little bit about the risks that you guys have and other miners have. We talked to Crypto Mags, I guess 2 weeks ago or last week, and she's got a lot of inroads with Canadian energy companies. She's done a lot of work on carbon credits in Ontario and other places. And she's, you know, she's, I think, saying without saying, probably because of her, you know, relationships in the industry, that there are energy companies, household names, significant, you know, market cap companies starting to really investigate whether or not they should be mining Bitcoin on their own. And so I view this as a risk to miners, but I've heard a couple of different answers as to why it's not. I'm curious what you think, because it seems to me that the companies that have the power, as you mentioned, right? I've heard you talk about the 3 M's. One of them is megawatts. And so naturally, these guys who have the juice, if they want to do this and undercut the miners, they're in a not a terrible position to do so. Do you view this as a risk, or do you view this as an opportunity to work with these companies? I got to know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so that's nothing new. Like for 4 years, we've been talking to energy companies who have been actively, like, they're pretty active. Like they're thinking about their business. They've had challenges in traditional Western markets with declining net retail demand from building out residential rooftop PV and the intermittent. Like they've been onto this for a long time. So that's nothing new in my opinion. The notion that they have some sort of competitive advantage when it comes to mining, I don't see it at all. At the end of the day, they own a generation facility that is producing electrons. They're grid connected. The electrons go into the network. It is a commodity that is priced in these deregulated markets every six minutes. There's a direct opportunity cost. Now, whether we buy the power at that price or whether they forego that price in revenue, it's kind of the same thing. Now, if they want to play funny economics and start cannibalizing their existing business model by pretending that their cost base is the cost of production rather than the cost of selling, then sure, but people don't do that, right? At the end of the day, there's a commodity. It's swimming around in these high voltage transmission lines. Whether the energy companies monetize it or whether we do, it's like it's the same effective cost. And arguably, like, this is a new industry, it's a new business, there's a new set of risks and operational issues to work through. We've had years of experience iterating these data centers, both from a construction, design, and operational phase. To expect energy companies to diversify away from managing generation infrastructure and customers into building data centers, I'm not sure I can subscribe to that, but there will always be exception. Like tomorrow someone will come out and announce that they are doing it, and that's fine, but I think it is a broad brush stroke. It's probably not a huge competitive advantage for them.
What's the best way to combat the narrative that Bitcoin itself uses too much energy? Because you always have this topic of discussion that's being floated around by even some very prominent senators in the United States. So if you were to try to combat it, I mean, you definitely have skin in the game here. What is the approach that you would take to try to stem this argument?
Yeah, there's a few ways. Everything uses energy. And some of these arguments you would have heard elsewhere, right? Like, we choose to play the Xbox and watch Netflix instead of playing board games. We're too lazy to hang our clothes outside to dry, so we use a clothes dryer. It's like it all uses energy. If you've got an issue with the way energy is produced, then go and talk to the people that are producing energy. Don't penalize technology and innovation, because that's what has got humanity to where it is today. And I don't think anyone's going to argue that. I think it normally goes hand in hand with we don't see the value in Bitcoin, so therefore any use of energy is a waste of energy. To which I'd say, if Bitcoin has no value, it doesn't use any energy. It, by definition, the only reason any power is used to secure this network is because the market has ascribed a value to that commodity. And it's like, you can sit here and say, but Xbox is better, clothes dryer is better. And I'll sit here and say, well, what about securely storing $1 trillion worth of people's savings and hard-earned labor around the world from censorship debates? I think that's pretty valuable as well. But this is the noise in the world we live in, and, you know, the fundamentals. So that's one way to attack it. The other way is to say, look, there's sensitivity, there's education, there's awareness, but also think about how your facilities and how you can be a good corporate citizen, get that social license to operate in other ways. Think more holistically. And that comes back to our energy market strategy, our community strategy, et cetera.
Dan, you mentioned earlier, and to your credit, you're, I think, one of the miners that, you know, of the many we've spoken to who doesn't mine Ethereum, doesn't dabble in Web3, doesn't do any of these, you know, I'm not planning on seeing the Iris NFT collection anytime soon. So explain to me, and maybe to the listeners and viewers as well, because I'd like to know what the thinking was in your mind, in the mind of your brother as well, and other people who were, you know, involved in that decision to only mine Bitcoin and stay with it. Because, it, you know, certainly to your point about noise, there's been quite a bit around Ethereum as this more functional, more versatile asset and network, and the things you can do, and, you know, that you can't do on Bitcoin, for example, with smart contracting or other applications. You guys, to your credit, you stayed away from that. When other miners, I'm thinking specifically in about Hut at the moment, who's been very, very vocal about all sorts of Web3 and Ethereum based stuff in the last, you know, 2 or 3 months. What is the reason you didn't enter originally, And how have you guys managed to stay out? And maybe as a third sort of prong here, what do your investors think about that? Are they asking you similar questions, or are they all in on the Bitcoin mission like you guys are?
So in terms of the underlying business and focusing on building data centers and Bitcoin mining, it's been a bit of a case of stay true to your knitting, stick to what you're good at and where you have a competitive advantage. For us to diversify into NFTs, Web3, et cetera, I'm not really sure we've got a competitive advantage. So I think that's part of it. The other part is I think Bitcoin is different. Like, I think we all acknowledge that, right? Like, it's truly decentralized. It's a one and zero invention. It's a commodity. It's institutional grade. I think when you look at things like Ethereum, like, you know, I went through the whole ICO boom in 2017, was pretty disenchanted by what I saw. And, you know, that helped double down on Bitcoin and say, yeah, this is very clear. Product market fit, finished product for a decade. We know where this is going. But I'm also not completely blinkered to all the innovation happening in the space, right? Like, there is some good stuff happening. I don't get my head fully around it, but the whole metaverse is coming. We're all going online. Cryptography, blockchain, I hate even using that word, but like, in a world where, yeah, you know, everyone's trying to disintermediate these central authorities, tech companies, governments, because of censorship, privacy, encroachment, this is the technology that facilitates the transition to a peer-to-peer world. So I don't want to write that off, and I think there will be good things, but for us, Bitcoin's here to stay, very easy to get your head around. I think it probably resonates quite well with the institutional market as well, that's also trying to get their head around the whole space, because Bitcoin is relatively simple. The ones and zeros is a feature, not a bug. And then, you know, at a simple level, you look at Ethereum and these other protocols, they're just solving different problems. They need more flexibility in terms of how the monetary policy is governed, how the code base is governed, how the consensus protocol is going to evolve over time. And I'm really trying not to say that in a negative sense. Like, that's a good thing for innovation, because they're trying to work out how to find that product market fit and create innovation in the space. But for us, and looking at what we're doing, like, I'll give you one downside. We go and buy a bunch of GPUs, go and mine Ethereum, and then tomorrow it goes to proof of stake. And like, well, that was a bit silly. And I think there's one other point I'd add. Philosophically, it doesn't feel intuitive to me that you need more than one proof of work coin. Have one, network effect, everything gets anchored back to it. Like, you've got the blockchain. If you want to build stuff on top, just anchor back to the source of truth. You don't need to be running multiple parallel proof of work chains. But
the source of truth, Len. The source of truth. Love it.
Yeah, you have to put laser eyes on the Iris Energy logo now, because you focus to the cause here, which is great. I want to just slightly change the topic here, but I want to talk about mining Bitcoin, potentially mining Bitcoin in an arid area like the desert, for instance. Is it possible in today's environment, or even in the very near future, that you're going to see Bitcoin miners set up shop in areas like that are far away from urban environments, that they could harness the power from the sun to use that to mine Bitcoin? Is this something that's just science fiction right now, or is it something that's going to be a reality in the not too distant future? Because Australia has a lot of desert area that they could potentially tap into, but I just want to know if this is even a realistic something that's even going to be possible in the not too distant future.
Yeah, and you kind of start going down the rabbit hole, and we've heard Ross at NYDIG, Michael Saylor, talk about this and how, you know, this access to remote energy can drive innovation at a kind of societal level with, you know, you go and locate close to an enormous source of hydro energy where the economic feasibility of building transmission lines means that it hasn't been developed, but you can develop your own kind of internal community. I think that's real over the long term. And I think what's also real is you can mine this stuff off a 4G connection. Like, you're not broadcasting massive packets of data. So you've got enormous geographic flexibility already with where you mine. And that's only going to innovate further with the satellites and these other networks being developed. And it's really interesting, because you look at aluminium smelting, which some people use as an analogy, where Bitcoin mining is the modern day equivalent. That was set up going to the source of low cost excess energy and monetizing it into a commodity. We're all doing the same thing in Bitcoin. But the key difference is logistics on getting that commodity to market. very different pinging a data packet over the internet versus having to navigate real world logistics around rail, trucks, ports, ships, etc. So it's a fascinating, I think that just adds to the further prospect of decentralization of the network, where you can go to the source of low cost renewables in particular and harness it.
Len, I don't have any more questions. Should we move to the final?
I have one more.
Hit him with it.
It's a really simple one. I would imagine you are using a mining pool because it kind of makes sense to do so. Which one are you using and why did you choose it? I'm curious, what was the rationale for choosing that one?
I'm not sure we've said publicly.
Okay, forget it. I didn't ask you this question. Forget it.
We're onboarded with like 4 or 5, I think, at the moment. And it's very the reason it's very interchangeable, right? Like it's a drop-down box equivalent. I'll probably leave it there just because I'm not sure we've said the exact name publicly.
Well, don't forget I asked it. Forget it.
You almost got it. That was close.
I was just curious. I didn't want to put him in an awkward situation. So we could just move to the next question. No biggie.
Well, Dan, the last question is not related to Bitcoin. It's related to your personal life, in which I will try and stir up a little bit of turmoil for you here. So your brother, Will, who's your co-CEO, co-founder, if you guys are in a parking lot, okay, and it's an asphalt paved parking lot, 40 yards away, there's a checkered flag, and you guys are both in your favorite pair of running shoes, shorts, t-shirts, whatever. Who's winning that 40-yard foot race, and by how much?
Well, he's got a really bad ankle, and I won't give up my football career and keep tearing my hamstrings, so there's a chance no one makes it.
What position did you play in football? Remember, it's not North American football, Joey. This is
I know.
Australian football.
Aussie, yeah.
Up forward, full forward, yeah.
I was gonna say, when I was looking at the website, I'm thinking Dan doesn't look like he's missed many meals, man. I bet you this guy can move the bar. Are you still benching? How much you bench?
Oh, I don't know. I don't do a lot of it.
Oh, 100. My. That's easy. I think that Dan's probably a two-wheel guy, Len. I'm pretty sure. 225. I'm sure Dan can get that up a few times.
I didn't even see him, so I can't say.
Dan, you're a great guest. Tell people where they can find you, where they can find Iris Energy, all that good stuff. Floor's all yours, buddy.
Sure. We're on LinkedIn. We're on Twitter. We've got our website. We're NASDAQ listed. Publish a monthly report. It's pretty easy to find us and appreciate all the community engagement we've had so far.
That's awesome. Dan Roberts, co-CEO, co-founder, Iris Energy. Thanks for coming on, brother. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.
The Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program.